The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guest this evening. A contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine and the 1619 Project, Linda Villarosa has won numerous awards for articles concerning issues of Black mother and infant health, medical myths, America's hidden HIV epidemic, environmental justice, and COVID-19's toll on Black American communities. She's the author of Body and Soul, The Black Woman's Guide to Physical Health, and the novel Passing for Black, which was nominated for a Lambda Literary Award. The director of the undergraduate journalism program at City College of New York, she formerly worked as executive editor at Essence Magazine and as a science editor for the New York Times. She joins us this evening with her powerful book, Under the Skin. Please welcome Linda Villarosa to the Free Library.
Well, first, I'm super glad to be here in Philly, but also to be in a library. I wanted to be a librarian forever, and I sort of got sidetracked and became a journalist, but that was my real first love. I also spent a lot of time here in Philly reporting on environmental justice, and it was, you know, one of the most important, what should have been 6 months and year and a half of my career. So thank you. I am a person who likes numbers, so I'm going to start to talk about kind of thinking behind my book, Under the Skin, by starting with some statistics. And I'm also, this is the first time I've been able to do a lecture with the paperback, so it's like nice and light and inexpensive. So really glad about that. But in America, we are the richest country in the whole world. We spend more on healthcare than any other wealthy country, which is about $12,000 per person per year. But money does not translate into good health in America in general. We have, compared to other wealthy countries, we have the highest rate of infant mortality. We have the highest and growing rate, compared to other wealthy countries, of maternal mortality. We live fewer years than lower life expectancy than other wealthy countries. But what happens is, you know, I've been thinking about this a long time. Whenever I kind of ask this question or talk about this disconnect, it's always met with confusion. The other thing that happens is, you know, people will say, which is true, what we need is more healthcare. And it's sort of like, we do need more healthcare. We need it to be free. We need universal healthcare in this country. Period. So we always have to start with that. But what I'm most interested in is what has happened in this country to the health of Black Americans. And even if there was universal healthcare, the gap in life expectancy, the gap in infant maternal mortality would still not completely go away. In this country, Black American babies are more than twice as likely to die before reaching age one. We have maternal mortality gap. We're 3 to 4 times more likely a black birthing person to die or almost die than a white mother. And then we have the lowest life expectancy. Before COVID, we lived 3.5 years fewer than the average white person, and now it's 6 years. And when you think about this question, and I've been thinking about it for a really long time, since I was a young editor at Essence Magazine, I began there in the late 80s, it's always these two things. It's like something's wrong or different about Black people's bodies that is causing these problems, or Black people are doing something wrong. Or all Black people are poor, and that's what's causing it. So let's just get the poverty question out of the way. Certainly, it's unconscionable that there are so many poor, impoverished Black Americans. Our poverty rate is about 19%. But when I was a little girl growing up, and when I was born, 1959, the poverty rate of Black Americans was 60%. Then after the Civil Rights Movement, that went down to 40%, and now it's 19. So even though poverty has dropped, you haven't seen the same kind of narrowing that you would if this were simply a question of poverty of the racial health disparities. And in some ways, if you look at maternal mortality, it's actually worse. So why would that be? The poverty answer does not make sense. So the second thing, and I think we're over this part, is that there is something different about Black genetics that is causing us to live fewer years and causing our babies to die and mothers to die. I think pretty much we've moved that off the table. But what remains is this blame, that it's something we are doing wrong as individual Black people, which is bringing down the health outcomes of Black Americans as a whole. And I don't want to sound like some kind of egomaniac, like I'm the person who figured this out, because I was wrong when I first started my career. And in fact, the first chapter of my book is called Everything I Thought Was Wrong. So I'm going to read a little bit about that, about my early years of Essence, and how I was thinking of Black health through the personal responsibility lens. And I was sure. At Essence, that was kind of our motto, is to really have individual Black women who were our readers, millions of them, just do everything better to raise the health outcome of the race itself. I approached Essence's mission with passion and steely focus through a Washingtonian, Booker T, lens of individual self-improvement, helping people help themselves and uplifting those who couldn't. I never strayed far from the belief that people had the power to save their own lives in the face of health disparities described in detail in the Heckler Report. And the Heckler Report, which was named after Margaret Heckler, who was the Secretary of Health, was really the first time that racial health disparities got, you know, there was a report about that. And I remember reading it like it was a novel. I understood that my life's mission at the time was to provide Essence's readers with solid, practical self-help information about diet, exercise, and other kinds of self-care so individuals could be healthier, which could raise the health status of the entire Black community. I imagined a kind of trickle-down effect from the health information our magazine provided. I promoted an each-one-teach-one mentality that encouraged readers to make sure all the sisters in the lives of our largely middle-class audience, read your less educated and privileged family and friends, understood the importance of good health and how to achieve it. It was us and them, us, the educated middle-class Blacks like me and my relatives, and them, the economically challenged Blacks whose image shone brightly in full-spectrum dysfunction in the American media, then as now, dominated largely by upper-middle-class, largely white male producers, editors, reporters, and writers. At Essence, our staff of mainly Black women did not just feel responsible for those less fortunate Blacks, we were actually tasked with saving them. I recall being in an Essence staff meeting where our editor explained that each of us was responsible for the lives of 8 Black women. I remember coming home late one night and I was walking up the subway steps exhausted on my way back to Brooklyn from Manhattan, and I thought, no wonder I'm so tired. I've got 8 women tethered to me and I just drag them up the stairs. While I wasn't crass enough to blame poor African Americans for their own plight, I fell prey to limiting media-driven stereotypes of Black people. I had spent my early years growing up on the south side of Chicago in the all-Black neighborhood where my mother had been born and raised, and we lived in a building owned by my grandparents. As a child, I was influenced by my parents' complaints about Chicago and their whisper-hiss conversations about how they had to get us out of the city and we needed to start a new life. By the time I was in third grade, the city's homicide rate had more than doubled from a decade before, and nearly a third of all Black residents lived below the poverty line. At first, my parents wanted to move to a predominantly white suburb near my father's job as a bacteriologist at Heinz VA Hospital. but while looking for a home, my mother asked a police officer in the area, would we be safe as a black family? And he told her, well, I can't guarantee that we can protect you and your family. Well, okay. Finally, in 1969, my father requested a transfer to Denver, and my parents packed up our Rambler station wagon and moved the family to the suburb of Lakewood, Colorado. We were part of a larger trend of black suburbanization that began to reverse the tendency of so-called chocolate cities and vanilla suburbs. In the 1970s, the overall black population in American suburbs increased by 70% as African-American families like mine moved to the suburbs, taking advantage of a world newly expanded by civil rights legislation that finally dislodged some of the institutional discrimination in housing and education. Leaving Chicago, the only city she had ever known, and moving far away from her parents and extended family was gut-wrenching for my mother. But like so many parents of the era, mine wanted to get out of the hood and give my sister and me a better childhood than they had had. To them, that meant we would grow up in a house with a backyard, not an apartment near the Dan Ryan Expressway, and go to a school with a cafeteria, not to run to the church across the street at noon to eat a free lunch served by Christian volunteers in the basement. We would learn alongside the white kids, play outside with them in the safe streets of our suburban community, and get all the privileges generally reserved for them. We were what are sometimes called integration babies. The year after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated and we drove up to our new ranch house just west of Denver, so much larger than the apartment where we live with my grandparents in Chicago, I asked, Daddy, do we have to share it with another family? My sister was even more amazed. Are we rich? Then we saw it. Somebody had written, in words, get out, on the garage door and on the pavement of the driveway. Some of the neighbors, all white, were trying to scrub it off before we arrived, but it was too late. My father wanted to get right back in the car and drive home to Chicago, but my mother and the neighbors persuaded him to stay. We later found out it had been the twin boys two doors down who delivered the newspaper who had defiled our new home on a dare. Their father made them apologize by delivering the paper for free for 2 months, paid out of their allowance as punishment. I would not have a true understanding of the depth and breadth of structural racism for a few more decades when I became a college professor and had to learn about and then teach a new version of race theory to my black studies students. Without a more sophisticated racial justice framework, our family members lived by a pieced together set of principles that included hard work, determination, education, and religious conviction that we believe made us the better blacks, the good Negroes. While this philosophy improved our lives, it was not the full picture. And I write that part because I want to make it clear that when we have the mistaken idea that personal responsibility can change those statistics around racial health, that I believe that too. And that is, it is hard to dislodge those beliefs. But then something happened in my own family in 1999. By then, I was, you know, an adult. I was working at the New York Times newspaper. And I wrote about this story that really changed my framework. In 1999, my father, a college-educated man who had retired from his job as a manager in a division of a federal agency, became critically ill. In his early 70s, he was diagnosed with colon cancer, and as the disease worsened, he began to suffer from mild dementia. I lived in New York City, across the country from my hometown of Denver, so though my parents had been divorced for years, my mother agreed to manage his care. One day she called me and said, you need to come home. Your father needs you. He's in the hospital. She instructed me to dress in professional attire and to bring my business cards from the New York Times, where I was the editor of the health pages. When she picked me up at the airport, dressed in extremely corporate attire, looking like the hospital vice president she used to be, I asked her, what are we doing? Her reply was blunt. They are treating your father like, same word they had put on our garage, and we need to let them see who he is. When we arrived at the Veterans Hospital he insisted on, I was shocked by what I saw. My father, courtly, sophisticated, and always impeccably dressed, was frighteningly thin, disheveled, wearing a dirty hospital gown, his hair uncombed. Worse, he had restraints on his legs. As we walked in, an attendant was speaking to him in a disrespectful hiss. When I pushed past the attendant and leaned down to hug my father, he whispered, "Get me out of here." Everything changed once we arrived. My mother, flipping into an officious tone I barely recognized, set everyone straight, doctors, nurses, and hospital administrators. We showed them my father's college degrees, medals from his military service, and photographs of him pre-illness. I let his caregivers know that he had studied biology in college, so explaining things in a respectful way would help him understand what was going on and prevent him feeling afraid and angry. We made them see him beyond his race and the ravages of his illness. My father, who died several months after my mother and I visited him, did not deserve special treatment because of his class and education, but class was the only card my mother and I had to play, so we played it. But like anyone, he should have been treated with dignity. So I share these personal experiences to say that, you know, to sort of explain, and to, in this book, I use my own experience and my own changing what I believed, everything I thought was wrong, and to really have a understanding of the racial health gaps in America. What is going on with Black people in this country? And to say, to shift it from being this lens of personal responsibility and fault finding to something much more real and something much harder for some to understand. So the kind of three premises, you know, what's behind, what explains racial health disparities, and, you know, I'm going to take a step back and say, I had another turning point in 2017 when one of my friends presented me a report on maternal mortality. And at the time, most of us were thinking that, yes, we understand that the maternal mortality rate for Black women in this country is 3 to 4 times higher. It was, again, the assumption that either Black women were doing something wrong or that most of the women who were dying or almost dying in childbirth were extremely impoverished and living in pockets of poverty. She brought me this report and said, look at the numbers. Even if you are an educated Black woman with a college degree or even a master's degree, a PhD, a JD, or an MD, you are more likely to die or almost die having a baby than a white woman with an 8th grade education. And that's when I started to really think, I need to write more. I need to figure this out and unravel it. It's interesting because in February, in the New York Times, where I work, you know, I'm a contributing writer there, and the New York Times doesn't use the word rich very often. Like, you don't put rich in a headline. But their headline in February was that rich Black families are more likely, the mother is more likely to die in childbirth than poor white families. Rich, rich. So when I saw rich, now you've combined education and wealth are not protecting Black birthing people in this country from dying, and it's only one person's body, so, or also losing the baby. Then it meant for me time to get it together and write this book. So now, when I look at racial health disparities, I look at them on the lens of three things. The first is that something about the communities we live in is less healthful, less healthy. It's harder to be healthy in the communities where we live. And usually in this country, we're blamed for that. But I did work in Chicago, where my mother and, you know, where we moved from, where they were from. Chicago has the widest gap in life expectancy racially. Where my mother grew up and where I lived until I was a little girl, people lived to only age 60. I would be dead by now if they, on average. And then 9 miles north, they lived to age 90. So that's the widest gap, 30 years. When you look back at that, all of those places where people are dying youngest in Chicago, you can put a map of redlining right over the top, and it matches up. So redlining meant people like my ancestors who came up from Mississippi with money in their pockets to buy homes couldn't buy them when they got there in the 30s, 40s, and even longer, because we weren't allowed, our communities were redlined, so we couldn't get mortgages. Then what happened on top of that is, you know, there are people, predators, came in and said, oh, black people with money, we will sell you your house for more money than it would be sold to a white person, and you can't have a mortgage, but you can have a contract. So a contract meant that you bought the house, but you never got any equity in it. So you could lose it at any time. Now we know that that practice, the combination of redlining and contract buying, as it was called, sapped away $3.5 billion of wealth from Chicago, black wealth. I asked my mother, you know, we did have that house in Chicago where my grandparents owned it, and I said, how did grandfather get that house? Because I was reading about redlining, and she said he bought it on some kind of contract, and he was always terrified he'd lose his house. So if these are the communities, it's not shocking that if our communities have wealth sapped away from them, that means that they have health sapped away from them. What that also means is that our communities are more likely to be polluted, the air, the water, the land. And you saw that in, I remember at the beginning of the pandemic, I was writing about COVID and racial health disparities. And I remember getting a report from the Harvard School of Public Health, and it was saying how high the COVID rates were in Louisiana, in Cancer Alley, the most polluted strip of land basically anywhere. And I thought, no wonder people are dying and having higher hospital rates in this area where the air is so polluted. And remember, COVID affects the lungs. All right, so that's the first thing. Those are called the social determinants of health. I didn't even want to say that phrase because it's so wonky, but people in public health know. And, you know, someday we'll come up with a better way to say the environments we live in. But until then, so the first problem is the social determinants of health in black communities. The second is something called weathering. So who's heard of weathering here? Okay, so good audience. That term was coined by Dr. Arlene Geronimus, who, when she first coined it as a student at Princeton, young student, she first began thinking about this, and then throughout the beginning of her career, she was completely dismissed. It was when COVID happened that her ideas started getting elevated. Weathering is what happens to people who are marginalized and who are oppressed and have to fight against those challenges. And it means that the systems of the body are prematurely aged. So that's the weathering effect. The same way a house would be weathered by a storm, like the paint would chip off, the shingles would fall, the windows would break. That's the weathering effect. And Dr. Geronimus, who has a new book out, it's about 6 weeks old, because now her work has been uplifted. She also has the flip side, believes in the flip side of weathering, which is we weather this storm. We weather the storm of America with kinship, with love, with family and communities. What's good about her book is she centers it on the black people in America, but anyone can be weathered if you are constantly having to fight against the sources of injustice. That's the second thing. Black people are weathered, simply weathered, and so you see lower life expectancy. You see higher rates of infant mortality because often weathering shows up as a stress test during childbirth. So we've got the social determinants of health in our communities, we have weathering, and the third is discrimination in the healthcare system itself. So it is what happened to my father. That wasn't a one-off. I think what hits me now is the story of Dr. Susan Moore, who was a physician in Indiana. She contracted COVID in 2021. She went into the hospital system of Indiana, where she was a physician. She tried to voice her legitimate concerns of pain, which were ignored. She tried to talk about the kind of protocol that she should get as a patient. She was completely shut down. With tubes in her nose, at her hospital bed, she made a video of herself, which a lot of people saw was viral, where she said, this is how I'm being treated. This is how black people get killed. She said throughout her video, she said, this is how black people get killed. What she did, she got out of that hospital, thank God, but then she died. So she died at the end of 2021. In the investigation of the hospital system, one of the things they found was some of the hospital staff was intimidated by her medical knowledge. So why would you be killed in the hospital? Because you have more knowledge. That is discrimination in the very system that she worked in. And sometimes I don't like to, I speak at medical schools. I spoke at Temple, which was really wonderful. I've spoken at some other medical schools. But sometimes I don't like to bring it up, to talk about discrimination in the healthcare system itself. Because I don't think individual black people should be blamed for the health of our whole race, I also don't think individual doctors, unless you're like a Proud Boy or something, should be blamed for what happens that is baked into the system in America. We have to think about this differently. But I was at a medical school in a city called Boston, and there were me, I'm here, and then there was Dr. Man here and Dr. Guy here. And so we were talking about discrimination in the healthcare system, and I didn't want to be the one. But they were saying, well, we really need more evidence of this. We just need more evidence. I'm like, no, we don't. I popped off. I'm like, no, we don't. We don't need any more evidence. All the evidence we need came in unequal treatment. 20 years ago, it's the 20th anniversary of the publication this year, which looked at 483 other studies. And it found clear discrimination against black people and sometimes other people of color. This is a really good gold standard report. We're looking at it, someone is, I'll probably be reporting on it, but someone's looking at it again, a group of people, some who were involved with the initial report, are looking to see what's changed in the last 20 years. So it'll be interesting. So I'm like, we need no more evidence. One of the studies in that, the 483 was about diabetes and amputation. And it looked at patients who had an equal access to health care and the equal severity of diabetes. Yet the black patients were much more likely to get an amputation. So I don't think we need any more evidence. We have it. It's in a gold standard report. But also, people telling their stories. Me as a journalist, I hear a lot of stories. Me as an author, I hear a lot of stories from people talking about how they were treated so poorly in the healthcare system itself. So I think now is a time for change. I am everybody that knows me knows I'm a half glass, really full person. And I have seen change. When I came and spoke at Temple, I was really moved by the enthusiasm and the willingness of to change the system of medical education. To say, we want our education to be different. We want to be different kinds of healthcare providers. I was at the Columbia School of Nursing about 6 weeks ago, and there was an assistant professor, and I can't remember what exactly her class in part of the clinical track. So she held up the textbook that she reads, and it had all these X's in it. She was crossing out the things that were incorrect in the textbook. And she said, this is just how I use it now. And we all stood up and applauded her. So I think I see change happening. I have this really kind of great news story that I can't wait to share. And it's about, starts with J. Marion Sims. So if you know who he is, he was forever called the father of modern gynecology. And there's this, his cure for fistula, which is an extreme side effect of childbirth, is widely considered one of the 50 most amazing medical breakthroughs in history. When you see him, he's always there's a painting of him in 1930. So when you talk about, you know, what he did, there's this painting, and it's a black woman on a table, fully clothed, him with his arms over here. He's in something that looks like a suit. There's two other women on the side, And then there's two other doctors in the room. So he practiced in the 1800s, mostly in Montgomery, Alabama. But that picture is not correct. He was practicing on three enslaved women who had names, Lucy, Anarka, and Betsy. They were not clothed. They were naked on the table with him there doing the experimentation to get this right, no anesthesia, to fix this fistula problem over and over and over on these women. The other two women weren't standing there. They were holding the one that he was working on down. And the reason I know this isn't because I did all this investigation. He wrote it in his book called My Story. So he wrote in detail about it. I just read it because of the myth that black people didn't feel the same amount of pain. Okay, so in New York, he had a statue, which was in Central Park. It was there forever, father of modern gynecology. A few years ago, after sustained protest, the statue was taken down. I live in Brooklyn. People keep saying that statue of your J. Marion Sims is somewhere in your borough, but wherever it is, it's gone. But in Montgomery, Alabama, the statue is still up. So this is so great. So there is an artist and activist named Michelle Browder who erected the Mothers of Gynecology. And it is a larger-than-life, beautiful sculpture tribute to Lucy and Anarka and Betsy. And it's right near the Legacy Memorial, so you can just, on your tour of Montgomery, you can just go by. But now she's done something even more amazing. She bought the land where J. Marion Sims had his clinic, where he was torturing those women, and she's making it into a birthing center where she can educate doulas and midwives. I'm like, oh. And so even though I started out with a lot of negative statistics about what's going on in this country, especially with black people, black birthing people especially, I'm really hopeful. I'm hopeful when I see medical students. I'm hopeful when I see the activism of people like Michelle Browder. I'm hopeful when I think of the care that doulas and midwives and other community health workers give to people. And we can no longer assume that just throwing more money and more innovation and more technology in healthcare is going to fix our communities, is going to fix societal discrimination and racism. But some of the answers to these questions are simpler and less expensive. And that is using community health workers, doulas, to make a caring link between people. Listening to medical students and nursing students and midwifery students and other people who want to go into public health saying, we want to do things differently. We want to learn to listen more. And I want you to take organic chemistry, yes. But I also want our students to have what they want, which is to learn better listening skills, learn how to be more patient-focused. And it was at Temple, when I was here not long ago, where there was a medical student who talked about feeling helpless because she was the lowest, you know, ranking person in the room, and she could see that the patient that they were working on was suffering a bit. And I remember we asked her, I said, she was upset. She said, I feel like I didn't do anything. And I said, what did you do? And she said she looked the woman in the eye and held her hand. And I thought, that's the kind of healthcare providers of the future who can do both. Help the person physically, having all that they learned in medical school, but then having the emotional connection, which is real. Thank you. I'm here for your questions.
Thank you so much for your talk. I know our audience will have a ton of questions for you. Who is brave enough to go first?
Thank you so much for that talk. I'm curious, in your work as a journalist, what your experience has been sort of convincing your own editors and your media institution that you're working in that the story you want to tell that's maybe about these kind of systemic disparities is worth telling and is important and worth your time.
I really appreciate that question, and it's funny because my editor, I teach journalism students, and my editor came to class the other day, and she said that a friend told her that I wanted to pitch a story to her. And at first she was kind of like, oh, Everybody wanted to pitch stories to the New York Times Magazine. But then she read my pitch. And my pitch was about HIV/AIDS in the South. And I was scared because I had used to work, you know, I had worked in the science pages, and I had earlier in my career had gotten some pushback, especially about HIV/AIDS. It was sort of like, well, that's over here in America, the problems in Africa, you know, this is where we need to focus our energy. People don't get that. And I'm like, well, actually, we still get that, and we still die from HIV in this country. So I showed my pitch, I dragged it up and showed it in class. It was the most detailed pitch you have ever seen. There was no way they could say no to this. So that's what I do, is I always expect a little bit of pushback and then go overboard with proving that whatever the story idea is a thing. I was asking Jessica to remember when I sent her the maternal mortality pitch. I pitched at the same time the piece about Philly and environmental justice and the maternal mortality. She said the pitches were so strong and so compelling that she said, do this one first and this one second. I think what happens to me at the New York Times is I try to sometimes put too positive of a spin on it. So my maternal mortality pitch was at first about the power of doulas. Then it became, whose fault is it that black birthing people are dying in America? And then you can also say doulas help, but your whole story cannot be about doulas. So I think I try, and here I'm Philly Thrive. I had Philly Thrive, was at the center of my story. The group and all the wonderful people stayed at the center of the story, but I also had to talk about the social determinants of health and why, you know, because my editor's like, well, whose fault is it? What happened here? And I was like, well, I did a lot of research. They placed public housing really close to this refinery, and then people bought their own houses in the places where, you know, they had love and community and kinship, and they were continuing to be poisoned. So I think the New York Times doesn't fight me anymore. They push me to go further.
Hi, Linda. Thank you for that presentation. I am a little bit less optimistic than you are. So as I'm listening to what you said about your optimism about medical students, I'm also remembering, and you'll correct this for me because I'm not going to say it quite right, that in the past several years there was research published around maybe medical residents still believing that black people had thicker skin and still believing that we were more tolerant of pain than white people. I'm also listening to your own John Henryism in your creation of your pitches to get them through at the New York Times. I'm thinking about my own efforts in that regard, where I'm a writer. I pitched COVID stories at the beginning of COVID, knowing that it was going to impact black people and brown people disproportionately and could not get them published. Okay. I'm also thinking about Philadelphia, which is a very blue city. We have like the blue candidates running, right? We have a city full of people who certainly during kind of 2020 and the whole George Floyd uprising, we're doing a lot of reflective work around anti-racism and taking on their internalized white supremacy or white dominant culture, all that kind of stuff. And we have these really fantastic world-class institutions here, many of which provide healthcare. So you talked about Temple, and I'm not saying Temple or not Temple, but so given that, we also had some huge failures here in Philadelphia during COVID, right? Right at the point where people were most aware of racial disparities and the data were being published about how disparate the impact was upon black and brown people. And so I'm, and low-income people as well. So I'm a little less optimistic than you, and I'm curious what kinds of things we might be looking at institutionally, structurally. Yeah, I want to focus on that level more so than the individual heroics and extra effort and the wonderful hearts of young people who I agree are changing. They're coming into these institutions that have great equity statements, and still, yet and still we see, mm-hmm. right, disparities. So I've said too much, but you know what I'm saying.
I know what you mean. And thank you for that. And I want to acknowledge that, thank goodness for your, Hillary's one of those people who, there were a bunch of us having these underground conversations about that COVID's going to hit Black people harder, even like in February of 2020 and earlier. And you were one of the people. And I'm glad we had those conversations to get the stories rolling. And it really was unfair about that you didn't get some of your stories in. I think things have changed more, but since that, and I do not think that we should have to have, you know, suffered through an international pandemic. I do not think George Floyd and others should have been murdered to get the attention of America, but I do think it made a difference. And I have seen more change than I was seeing before. Sometimes, like when I'm speaking to groups, and I get the temptation to say, like, oh, young people will lead us out, and I got two young adults, very social justice-oriented children, but I don't. Probably the best organizing that I've ever seen in my whole life was here with Philly Thrive, because there were people of all ages. My favorite story about Philly Thrive was the group was going to protest against the refinery, and some of the older folks were in the back. The young folks were in the front going, we want to be arrested. We want to get arrested. And they were looking at those, you know, those ties on the police, looking like, oh, I can't wait till I'm arrested. The older people were like, I'm not getting arrested. I am not going there. That's not happening. And I just thought, oh, how wonderful that everybody has their place in this intergenerational community organizing against something that's really unhealthy in the communities that they live in. So I am a person who looks to the light and tries to lift up the people who want to do things differently. So I talk about medical students all the time. I talk about activism and also in hopes that it, you know, others will not give up the fight and keep the momentum going. So that's all I got for you.
Thank you very much for being here. And it was a little bit of a similar lines of, I think in the book you talk about, you know, this notion that doctors think people of color, particularly African Americans, have a higher threshold for pain and thicker skin. And if I remember, you had an anecdote there that almost it was a protective factor, I guess, in the case of opioids. And I just think that's worth people hearing, like this disparity now with opioid addiction being more prevalent potentially among white Americans may in fact be because Black folks didn't get prescribed painkillers.
Yeah.
Which is like discrimination actually helped in this case.
And also, that may be true, and also that white people were over-medicated right. for pain, so that we're getting under-medicated, and then others are getting over-medicated, but now it's catching up, so yeah. We just have an opioid crisis in this country. I think not long ago, I got an email from this guy from Virginia. The study about pain tolerance and thick skin and all that was out of the University of Virginia, so it was this guy really, really mad. And he's like, I heard you on the radio talking about that study from the University of Virginia. And I feel like my son was tricked into, he didn't understand the questions and on, I'm really angry. And then he said, but ha, 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 my son is now a doctor. So at first I thought, should I write back? No, nah. No, I'm not John Henry-ing this and trying to convince this guy. And then I thought, I'm glad that he had that experience. So he could see, he is a doctor now. So now he was shamed by that study into, you know, remembering, don't do that thing. And it kind of made me happy, but, you know, I don't like those letters. But, you know, I really do hope that things are changing, but I think things have to change systemically, institutionally, and structurally. So it can't be just these hard-driving medical students. It has to be, you know, if we're talking about medical school, if we're talking about institutions and organizations and agencies, it has to come from the top. In New York, it came from the top. Dr. Mary Bassett was our commissioner of health, and she mandated that all 7,000 people who worked for our Department of Health go through some kind of anti-racism training. And it was specific. It was that undoing racism. Everyone had to go through it. That's from the top down. Everybody had to do that. She said it was not pretty for some people. They were mad. But they had to do it. So I love the activism that comes from the students, but we can't just leave them out there alone trying to change the system alone. It has to come from all sides, and it has to be sustained.
Hello. Thank you again for doing this. The question I wanted to ask is, are there any health and disparity or business of health stories that you feel are underreported? I know that since the era of your New York Times Magazine piece and several others, I feel like you almost always, I mean, I get emails almost every day about pieces in local and national media that pertain to Black maternal health and mortality, but I was wondering if there are any underreported disparities that you think you'd like to see more of.
I think that the reporting that I am most impressed with now is local, really local reporting, especially at a time when local report, it's hard to have a local publication. There's a lack of newspapers. It's hard to, you know, sustain financially media. And when I see the local reporting digging down into what's happening in communities, especially that are hurting the most, I'm really interested in what's happening in the South. I always have been. I try to center a lot of my work in the South, a place, you know, largely left behind. You know, many of the politicians are doing things that are harmful to people. I think the story, I'd like to see more about mental health. I'm really, you know, interested in that. I think it's been poorly understood, mental health, Black people in this country. I'm interested in, I love the work that my other colleagues are doing around also the environment, because I think there's a lot of stories to tell. And one of the things, it's hard for me sometimes because I want to be the solution, but journalists, our job is really to go out and find some bad news and then, you know, dig deep and report on it. So I try to do my best to say, try to lift up the people and the places and the institutions that are doing good, but it's hard when you're a journalist and your job is literally to find the worst thing ever and then find out as much and blame somebody for it. So it's hard, but I thank you for that question, and you know, I do think about that a lot.
Thank you so much. I have a question about your experience in Morgantown, West Virginia. I'm actually from Morgantown, West Virginia, and I love that chapter. It kind of came out of nowhere in the book. And it kind of deviates from the rest of the book. So I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit to that. And incidentally, the Friendship House did close down.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay, I'll just say the truth. So, okay. So I get the deal for this book with my wonderful publisher, Doubleday, my fantastic editor, Chris. And so I was in a meeting and I said, okay, this book, you know this is a Black book, right? This is a Black book. Are we all good with that? And she's very funny. She goes, well, you know how like you're reading a book and then you get to the Black chapter? You can do a white chapter. I thought, oh, okay. I didn't know what it was. And then I was having a meal with Arlene Geronimus. And I was having her just really help me understand weathering. And she said, it's not a Black thing. Anyone who's treated badly will be weathered. They will have a premature, you know, death or, you know, shorter life. And live sicker, die quicker. And so I thought, where's the place where people who are not Black, I'm deviating, I'm like, where am I going to put my white chapter? And then I thought, West Virginia. And I had heard about an HIV/AIDS outbreak there because of injecting drug use. And so I just decided no one in my family thought this was a good idea because I came late in the game. I was trying to figure it out. So it was in the middle of COVID. I got into my little Prius and I drove to West Virginia from Brooklyn and went to Morgantown. I started in Morgantown at the Friendship House. And what I saw was, West Virginia is like 94% white or something like it's very white. I saw white people who were so ill and who were treated so badly, who were blaming themselves, just like the Black people that I had interviewed. And I remember talking to people, it's like, yeah, it's my own fault that I lost my job and this and that happened. I wish I had and I did. And I'm thinking, you know, in your state, what has happened to coal, the coal industry, which was dangerous and harsh before? What happened to your state when pharmaceutical companies pumped opioid pills, into that place, then pulled them back, and people got addicted to heroin. I was at a homeless shelter. I was at an encampment. I was at the Friendship House. And every single person that I saw, I guessed their age wrong. And I think I mentioned that in the book. I would be like, how old are you? In my head, 70. And the person's like, 48. And I called Dr. Geronimus, and I was like, I get it. I get it. These people are treated so badly. They're blaming themselves. They're really trying. And my family was really scared that I was going to this racist place and I was going to be killed. And I didn't feel that at all. I felt like people wanted to be listened to. I didn't get that people were like, who are you, black person? What are you doing here? I got that I sat with them, I talked to them, and heard their stories, and I was really sad. But I also understood that weathering is, that chapter's weathering happens to everybody. And I understood that, and I saw it for myself.
I think we have time for just one more question.
And West Virginia is really pretty. I went in the fall, and you know, I'm from Colorado, so I love the changing of the seasons, and it was really beautiful there.
Hi, thank you so much for speaking and for writing this book. I'm gonna speak from a medical lens. When I was reading this text, one of the things that I found very powerful is that a lot of this are things that we learn. We learn in medical school, we learn in our training. At least now, it's a little bit more prominent in some of the conversations, but at the end of the day, there's still very limited accountability for what we now know, and it still happens. And keeping colleagues and peers and other people accountable for this, there's no like metric for how do we assess how racist someone is and how they're treating a patient and how do we make sure that this doesn't continue or perpetuate. And what I found really profound in what you were saying is data. Like, I feel like we have all the data. The data's there. We show it. We highlight it. It's on the slide for every of those anti-racism presentations, but then it still happens. And so I kind of agreed a bit with some of the kind of concern about where this is going. So, you know, these are things that I'm going to continue to encourage, that we have conversations and do things to emphasize how important it is for our clinicians and learners to be really proactive. But I almost wonder, like, what your hope was for this text, at least for someone who is involved in medicine, and when you're having these conversations at different medical schools, what your hope is for the readers of this text in terms of kind of next steps.
Well, one of the things that I felt was really important was to have it in one place for everyone to understand. And it was funny because when I was writing my stories for the New York Times magazine, people would send me notes from medical schools and from nursing schools and places and said, or even like high schools sometimes, colleges, is it okay if we Xerox your stories and put them into a little packet together? And I thought, okay, why would you be doing that? That's so waste of time. I'm like, yes, do it. And I thought, oh, because there's no place, or there's not a, you know, place that is easy to figure out to get all the information. So I wanted to put it in one place so people could have it as a tool for discussion, a tool for just having it, you know, together. And, you know, I have heard about people using the book, the articles, to make change in their individual, you know, places where they are. I think the other thing that my daughter pointed this out to me, it's to also lift up the stories of individual people to say, you're not crazy. This did happen. This does happen. It's not your fault. And that's really big for me. It was interesting, several times when I was interviewing physicians, black women physicians, about something else, I would hear their own stories of how, you know, a lot of same thing I had, intrauterine growth restriction with my older child, a lot of being treated badly in medical school, a lot of trauma, small t. And I just wanted to say, it's not you. This does happen. And it happens to, if you're Dr. Susan Moore, if you're the person that had to wait, you know, 3 hours to get a, you know, an appointment for prenatal care. And I think I just want to, I'm a journalist, so I hope to bring information and news out in the open and for people to take it and use it in whatever way that is positive and helpful to change institutions, structures, and society. So, you know, sometimes I do feel bad. I'm like, should I have just gone to medical school? Should I have done, you know what I mean? Should I be in public health? And then I'm like, no, I am the person who's going to dig this up and put it out there and give it to you. And now it's your turn to take it and use it, not you personally, but hopefully you do, you know, and use it for change for the positive.
It's a perfect place to end. Thank you all so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.